even when they had fully recovered, felt troubled in their souls without realizing it, along with something strange inside that was the sinister wildness of the place creeping in. "Let's get out of here, and fast," said Fauchelevent. He fumbled in his pocket and pulled out a flask he had packed. "But first, a little drop," he said. The flask finished off what the unfettered air had started. Jean Valjean took a swig of brandy and felt thoroughly restored. He climbed out of the coffin and helped Fauchelevent nail the lid back on. 3 minutes later, they were out of the grave. After that, Fauchelevent was calm. He took his time. The cemetery was closed. There was no need to fear that Gribier, the gravedigger, would pop up. That conscript was at home, busy hunting around for his pass and not very likely to find it, since it was in Fauchelevent's pocket. Without a pass, he could not get back into the cemetery. Fauchelevent grabbed the shovel, and Jean Valjean the pick, and together they buried the empty coffin. When the grave was filled in, Fauchelevent said to Jean Valjean, "Come on, and we'll get going. I'll keep the shovel, and you take the pick." Night was falling. Jean Valjean had some trouble moving and walking. He had gone stiff in the coffin and turned into a bit of a corpse. The numbness of death had taken hold of him between those four planks. He needed, so to speak, to thaw out of the sepulchre. "You're stiff," said Fauchelevent. "What a shame I'm lame. We'd step up the pace, otherwise." "Bah," replied Jean Valjean, "I'll soon get my legs loosened up." They walked off down the paths the hearse had taken. When they got to the closed gate and the gatekeeper's pavilion, Fauchelevent, who was holding the gravedigger's pass in his hand, dropped it into his box. The gatekeeper pulled the cord, the gate opened, and they walked through.
"That was a breeze," said Fauchelevent. "What a brainwave you had, Father Madeleine."
They got past the Barrière Vaugirard without any trouble. In the neighborhood of a cemetery, a pick and a shovel are a couple of passports. The Rue de Vaugirard was deserted.
"Father Madeleine," said Fauchelevent, as he trotted along, glancing up at the houses, "your eyes are better than mine. Show me where number 87 is."
"Right here, actually," said Jean Valjean.
"There's no one around," Fauchelevent went on. "Give me the pick, and let me have a couple of minutes."
Fauchelevent went into number 87, climbed to the top of the stairs, guided by the instinct that always leads the poor man to the attic, and knocked in the gloom on the door of a garret. A voice answered. "Come in." It was the voice of Gribier. Fauchelevent pushed the door open. The gravedigger's dwelling was, like all such downtrodden abodes, a dump, unfurnished and cluttered. A packing case, perhaps a coffin, served as a console, a butter pot served as a drinking fountain, a straw mat served as a bed, the tiles served as table and chairs. In a corner, on top of a ragged scrap of old carpet, a thin woman and any number of children were huddled in a heap. The whole destitute interior showed traces of being turned inside out. You'd have said that it was the site of a one-man earthquake. Lids were thrown around, rags scattered, a pitcher broken. The mother had been in tears, the children had probably been beaten, traces of a furious and relentless search. It was clear that the gravedigger had desperately tried to track down his pass, and had taken his frustration at losing it out on everything in the dump, including his pitcher and his wife. He looked utterly distraught. But Fauchelevent was racing too fast toward the episode's denouement to notice this sad side to his triumph. He stepped in and said,
"I thought I'd bring back your pick and shovel."
Gribier watched him, stunned.
"And tomorrow morning at the cemetery gatekeeper's, you'll find your pass."
With that, he put the pick and the shovel down on the tiles. "What's the meaning of this?" asked Gribier.
"What the meaning of this is that you dropped your pass out of your pocket and I found it on the ground after you'd gone. I buried the dead woman, I filled in the grave, and did your work for you. The gatekeeper will give you back your pass, and you won't have to pay 15 francs. There you go, conscript."
"Thank you, villager," cried Gribier, dazed. "Next time, it's my treat." A successful interrogation. 1 hour later, in the dead of night, two men and a child presented themselves at number 62 Petite Rue Picpus. The elder of the men lifted the door knocker and knocked. This was Fauchelevent, Jean Valjean, and Cosette. The two old men had gone and gotten Cosette from the fruit hawker in the Rue du Chemin Vert, where Fauchelevent had dropped her off the night before. Cosette had spent the last 24 hours not knowing what to think and trembling silently. She trembled all the more as she had not wept. She hadn't eaten, either, or slept. The worthy fruit hawker had put 100 questions to her without getting more for an answer than the same mournful glance. Cosette did not let on for a second anything of all she had heard and seen over the last 2 days. She gathered that they were going through a crisis. She felt to her marrow that she had to be good. Who has not experienced the ultimate power of these three words delivered in a certain tone in the ear of a frightened child? Not a word. Fear is mute. Besides, no one can keep a secret the way a child can. Only when, after this grim 24 hours, she clapped eyes on Jean Valjean again, did she let out a yelp of joy in which any thoughtful soul who had overheard her would have picked up the sense of an escape from a bottomless chasm. Fauchelevent was from the convent, and he knew the passwords. Every door opened, and thus the terrifying twin problem was solved. How to get out, how to get in. The porter, who had his instructions, opened the little door of the tradesman's entrance that was connected to the garden courtyard and that you could still see from the street 20 years ago, standing opposite the porte-cochere. The porter let all three of them in through this door, and from there they reached the inner private visitor's room where Fauchelevent had received the prioress's orders the night before. The prioress was waiting for them, rosary beads in hand. One of the vocal mothers was standing by her side with her veil down. A discreet candle lit up, we might almost say pretended to light up, the visitor's room. The prioress gave Jean Valjean the once-over. No eye can scrutinize as thoroughly as a downcast eye. Then she questioned him. You are the brother?
Yes, Reverend Mother, replied Fauchelevent.
What is your name? Fauchelevent answered. Ultime Fauchelevent. He had in fact had a brother named Ultime who was dead. What part of the country are you from? Fauchelevent answered.
From Piquigny, near Amiens.
How old are you? Fauchelevent answered.
50.
What is your profession?
Fauchelevent answered. Gardener.
Are you a good Christian?
Fauchelevent answered. Everyone in the family is.
Is this little girl yours?
Fauchelevent answered. Yes, Reverend Mother.
You are her father? Fauchelevent answered.
Her grandfather. The vocal mother whispered to the prioress,
He answers well.
Jean Valjean had not uttered a word. The prioress examined Cosette closely and whispered to the vocal mother,
She will be ugly.
The two mothers chatted for a few minutes in voices barely above a whisper in a corner of the visitor's room. Then the prioress turned back and said,
Father Fauvent, you will have another knee pad and bell. We need two now.
The next day, in fact, two little bells could be heard in the garden, and the nuns could not resist lifting a corner of their veils. At the bottom, under the trees, two men could be seen digging side by side, Fauvent and another man. Obviously an enormous event. The silence was broken long enough to say, That's the assistant gardener. The vocal mothers added, He's one of Father Fauvent's brothers. Jean Valjean was, in fact, properly fitted out. He had the leather knee pad and the bell. He was now officially accepted. His name was Ultime Fauchelevent. The strongest determining argument for admission had been the prioress's observation about Cosette. She will be ugly. This prognostic declared, the prioress immediately took Cosette to her heart and gave her a place in the boarding school as a charity case. The move was only strictly logical. A lot of good it has done not having any mirrors in a convent, when women are so conscious of their appearance. Now, girls who feel they are pretty do not readily become nuns. Luckily, vocations declare themselves in inverse proportion to beauty, so hopes are higher for the ugly than for the beautiful. Hence, the keen preference for ugly ducklings.
The whole episode greatly enhanced Fauchelevent's standing. He had had a triple success, with Jean Valjean, whom he had saved and sheltered, with Gribier, the gravedigger who said to himself, "He saved me that fine," with the convent which, thanks to him, kept Mother Crucifixion's coffin under the altar, thereby eluding Caesar and satisfying God. There was a coffin with a corpse in Petit Picpus, and a coffin without a corpse in Vaugirard Cemetery. No doubt public order was profoundly disturbed, but it did not know it. As for the convent, its gratitude to Fauchelevent was great. Fauchelevent became the best of its servants and the most treasured of gardeners. At the very next visit of the archbishop, the prioress told the story to his grace, half by way of a confession, half by way of a boast. When he left the convent, the archbishop spoke of it, very quietly, with approval to Monsieur de Latille, confessor to Monsieur, brother to the king, and subsequently to the archbishop of Reims and a cardinal. Admiration for Fauchelevent travelled far and wide, for it got as far as Rome. We have actually seen a note addressed by the then-reigning Pope Leo XII to one of his relatives, a Monsignor Innunzio's residence in Paris, with the same name as himself, Della Genga. In it can be read these lines. It appears that in a convent in Paris there is an excellent gardener who is a saintly man known as Fauvent. Not a whiff of this triumph reached Fauchelevent in his shed. He continued to graft cuttings, to weed, and to cover his melon beds, without being brought up to speed on his excellence and his saintliness. He had no more suspicion of his splendid reputation than has a steer from Durham or Surrey, whose portrait is published in the Illustrated London News with this caption: "The steer that won first prize in the cattle show." Enclosure. At the convent, Cosette continued to keep silent. Cosette quite naturally thought she was Jean Valjean's daughter. Besides, not knowing anything, she could not say anything, and then, in any case, she would not have said anything. We have just noted that nothing teaches children silence like calamity. Cosette had been through so much that she was afraid of everything, even to open her mouth, even to breathe. A word had so often brought an avalanche down on top of her. She had only just begun to feel safe since she had been in Jean Valjean's hands. She got used to the convent quite quickly, only she longed for Catherine but did not dare say so. One time, though, she said to Jean Valjean, "Father, if I'd known, I'd have brought her along." In becoming a boarder at the convent, Cosette had to adopt the uniform worn by the students of the house. Jean Valjean obtained permission to keep the clothes she was stripped of. This was the same mourning outfit he had made her wear when she left the Thénardier's pothouse. It had not yet had much wear. Jean Valjean packed this outfit, plus her woolen stockings and her shoes, with ample camphor and all the aromatics convents abound in a little suitcase that he managed to procure himself. He put the suitcase on a chair by his bed, and he carried the key to it on him always. "Father," Cosette asked him one day, "what is that box over there, then, that smells so good?" Father Fauchelevent, apart from the glory we have just recounted, and of which he was completely ignorant, was rewarded for his good deed. First, he was glad he'd done it. It made him happy. And then, he had a lot less work to do now he was sharing the load. Last, he really loved tobacco, and he found Monsieur Madeleine's presence made it possible for him to take three times as much tobacco as in the past, and with infinitely more relish, since Monsieur Madeleine paid for it. The nuns did not adopt the name of Ultime. They called Jean Valjean the other Fauvent. If those holy old maids had had a fraction of Javert's perceptiveness, they would have wound up noticing that whenever there was an errand to run outside for the maintenance of the garden, it was always the elder Fauchelevent, the old one, the infirm one, the lame one, who went out, and never the other man. But either because eyes forever fixed on God don't know how to spy, or because they were, out of preference, busy watching each other, they noticed nothing. And Jean Valjean did well to keep quiet and not to move. Javert watched the quartier for a good long month or more. The convent was for Jean Valjean like an island surrounded by sheer cliffs. Those four walls were now the world for him. He saw enough of the sky from there to be serene, and enough of Cosette to be happy. A very sweet life began for him once more. He lived with old Fauchelevent in the shed at the bottom of the garden. This shack, built out of rubble and still standing in 1845, consisted, as we have already said, of three rooms, all of which were completely bare. Father Fauchelevent had insisted Monsieur Madeleine have the main room, and he was forced to accept it, for Jean Valjean had resisted in vain. The walls of this room, apart from two nails for hanging up the knee pad and the basket, were adorned only with an example of the royalist paper money of 93, stuck on the wall over the mantelpiece. Here is an exact replica. In the name of the king, negotiable bond of 10 livres, for objects supplied to the army, reimbursable in peacetime. Series 3, number 10390, Stoffler. The assignat from La Vendée had been nailed to the wall by the previous gardener, an old member of the Chouin party, who had died in the convent and been replaced by Fauchelevent. Jean Valjean worked all day in the garden and was extremely useful there. He had once been a pruner, after all, and was glad to find himself a gardener again. You will recall that he was full of all kinds of agricultural secrets and recipes for growing things. He put them to good use. Nearly all the trees in the orchard were wildings. He budded them and got them to yield excellent fruit. Cosette had permission to go and spend an hour each day with him. As the sisters were sad and he was good, the child compared him with them and worshipped the ground he walked on. At the appointed hour she would run to the shed. When she entered this hovel, she filled it with paradise. Jean Valjean flourished and felt his happiness growing from the happiness he gave Cosette. The joy we inspire has this wonderful feature, which is that, far from dimming like any reflection, it comes back to us more radiant. At playtime, Jean Valjean would watch Cosette playing and running around from a distance, and he could distinguish her laughter from the laughter of the other girls. For Cosette now laughed. Even the way Cosette looked had changed to a certain extent. All gloominess had vanished. Laughter is like sunshine. It chases winter away from the human face. Cosette was still not pretty, but she had become charming regardless. She had a way of coming out with quite grown-up little notions in her sweet, infantile voice. When playtime was over and Cosette had gone back in, Jean Valjean would watch the windows of her classroom, and at night he would get out of bed to watch the windows of the dormitory where she slept. Besides, God has his ways. The convent, like Cosette, contributed to keeping up and completing the work of the bishop inside Jean Valjean. There is no doubt that one side of virtue leads to pride. There lies a bridge built by the devil. Jean Valjean had perhaps been, without knowing it, fairly close to both that side and that bridge when Providence threw him into the Petit Picpus convent. While he had compared himself only to the bishop, he had found himself unworthy, and he had stayed humble. But for some little time, he had been comparing himself to other men, and pride had reared its ugly head. Who knows? He might well have ended up quietly returning to hate. The convent stopped him on that slippery slope. This was the second place of captivity he had seen. In his youth, in what had been for him the beginning of life, and then later, still only recently, he had seen another, an appalling and terrible place, whose austerities had always struck him as the iniquity of justice and the crime of the law. Today, after the galleys, he was seeing the cloister and thinking how he had been part of the prison system and was now a spectator, so to speak, of the cloister, and he compared them anxiously in his mind. Sometimes he would lean on his spade and slowly descend the endless spirals of his thoughts. He remembered his old companions and how miserable they were. They'd get up at the crack of dawn and work till nightfall. They were scarcely left enough time to shut their eyes. They slept on camp beds, where mattresses no more than 2 thumbs thick were the only ones allowed in rooms that were only heated in the rawest months of the year. They were dressed in hideous red smocks. They were allowed, as a favor, to wear burlap pants in heat waves and had a scrap of wool to slap on their backs in the coldest days of winter. They only drank wine and only ate meat when they were on hard labor. They lived without names, designated only by numbers, and in some way reduced to mere figures, their eyes lowered, their voices lowered, their hair shorn, under the rod, in shame. Then his mind reverted to the creatures he now had before his eyes. These beings, too, lived with their hair shorn, their eyes lowered, their voices lowered, not in shame, but in the full force of the world's scorn, their backs not bruised by the rod, but their shoulders lacerated by discipline. Their names had also vanished from among men, and they only existed now under the most austere appellations. They never ate meat and never drank wine. They were dressed not in red vests, but in black shrouds made of wool, heavy in summer, light in winter, without being able to take anything off or put anything on, without even being able to resort to cotton clothing or a woolen overcoat, according to the season. And for 6 months of the year they wore hair shirts that gave them fever. They lived not in rooms heated only in the worst days of winter, but in cells where fires were never lit. They slept not on mattresses, only 2 inches thick, but on straw. Last, they were not even allowed to sleep. Every night, after a day of toil, as they sank with exhaustion into first sleep, the very moment when they were dozing off, scarcely warming up a little, they had to wake up, get up, and go and pray in the icy dark chapel with both knees on the stone. On certain days, every one of these beings took a turn putting in 12 hours at a stretch, kneeling on the flagstones or prostrate face down on the ground, arms out on both sides, like a cross. The first lot were men. These were women. What had these men done? They had stolen, raped, looted, killed, murdered. They were bandits, forgers, poisoners, arsonists, murderers, parricides. What had these women done? They had done nothing. On one side, armed robbery, fraud, theft, violence, lechery, homicide, every known form of sacrilege, every variety of assault. On the other, one thing only. Innocence. Perfect innocence. Almost lifted aloft in some mysterious assumption, still tethered to the ground through virtue, already tethered to heaven through holiness. On one side, the whispered mutual avowal of crimes. On the other, the confession of sins said out loud. And what crimes? And what sins? On one side, primeval sludge. On the other, an ineffable perfume. On one side, a moral pestilence, kept in custody, penned in under cannon and slowly devouring the plague-addled victims. On the other, a chaste kindling of all souls at the same hearth. There, darkness. Here, shadow. But shadow full of flashes of light. And flashes of light full of radiance. 2 places of slavery. But in the first, deliverance is possible. A legal limit is always in sight. And there's always escape. In the second, perpetuity. The only hope in the extremely distant future, that glimmer of freedom mankind calls death. In the first, you are chained up in mere chains. In the other, you are chained by your faith. What emerged from the first? Endless malediction, the gnashing of teeth, hate, a desperate depravity, a cry of rage against human association, utter contempt for heaven. What issued from the second? Benediction and love. And in these 2 places, so similar and yet so different, these 2 species of being, so very different, accomplished the same duty, atonement. Jean Valjean understood perfectly well the atonement involved in the first, personal atonement, atonement for oneself. But he did not understand atonement for others, that suffered by these creatures blameless and without stain. And he asked himself with a shudder, atonement for what? What atonement? A voice in his conscience answered him, the most divine form of human generosity, atonement for others. Here we will refrain from adding our personal theories. We are merely the narrator, putting ourselves in Jean Valjean's shoes, seeing with his eyes and translating his impressions. He had before his very eyes the sublime summit of self-abnegation, the highest peak of virtue possible, that innocence that forgives men for their sins and atones in their stead. Servitude endured, torture accepted, torment sought out by souls who have not sinned in order to exempt from such torment souls that have faltered. The love of humanity losing itself in the love of God, yet remaining there distinct and imploring. Gentle, weak creatures taking on the misery of those who are punished and the smile of those who are rewarded. And he remembered that he had dared to feel sorry for himself. Often in the middle of the night he would get up to listen to the grateful chanting of these innocent creatures, overwhelmed by austerities, and he felt the blood run cold in his veins to think that those who were justly punished did not raise their voices to the heavens except to blaspheme, and that he, miserable bastard, had shaken his fist at God. One thing was striking, and gave him pause for profound thought, like a warning whispered by Providence itself. The walls scaled, fences hurdled, luck tried to the death, the long hard climb uphill, all these same efforts he had made to get out of the other place of atonement, he had made to get into this one here. Was this an emblem of his fate? This house was a prison, too, and looked horribly like the other abode he had fled. And yet he had never imagined anything remotely like it. He saw, once more, grates, bolts, iron bars. To guard whom? Angels. These high walls that he had seen around tigers, he saw them once more around sheep. This was a place of atonement and not of punishment. And yet it was even more austere, more mournful, and more merciless than the other one. These virgins were more savagely beaten down than the convicts. A cold, harsh wind, the wind that had frozen his childhood, swept through that grated, padlocked pit of vultures. An even more bitter and painful blast blew in this cage of doves. Why? When he thought of these things, everything in him became deeply absorbed in this mystery of sublimeness. In these meditations, pride evaporated. He circled himself over and over again. He felt himself to be puny, and he wept many times. All that had entered his life in the last 6 months brought him back to the holy injunctions of the bishop. Cosette, through love, the convent through humility. Sometimes in the evening at dusk, at the hour when the garden was deserted, he could be seen on his knees in the middle of the path that ran alongside the chapel, in front of the window he had looked in the night he arrived, turned to face the place where he knew that the sister making atonement lay in prostration and in prayer. He prayed, kneeling like this before this sister. It seemed that he did not dare kneel directly before God. All that surrounded him, the peaceful garden, the fragrant flowers, the children letting out joyful cries, these grave and simple women, the silent cloister, slowly penetrated him, and little by little his soul, filled with silence like the cloister, with perfume like the flowers, with peace like the garden, with simplicity like the women, with joy like the children. And then he reflected that it was two houses of God that had taken him in, one after the other, at the two critical moments of his life. The first, when all doors had shut in his face and human society had pushed him away. The second, at the moment when human society had set off after him again, and when jail was once more opening its doors. And that without the first, he would have lapsed into crime again. And without the second, into torment. His whole heart melted in gratitude, and he felt more and more love. Several years went by this way. Cosette was growing up. Part 3. Marius. Book 1. Paris, studied down to its minutest atom. Parvulus. Paris has a boy, and the forest has a bird. The bird is called a sparrow, and the boy is called a ragamuffin imp, a street urchin, le gamin. Put these two ideas together, the one containing all the heat of a furnace, the other all the light of dawn, strike these two sparks together, Paris, boyhood, and a small being will flare up as a result. Homuncio, as Plautus would say. This small being is bursting with joy. He doesn't eat every day, but he goes to a show every night, if he feels like it. He doesn't have a shirt on his back, or shoes on his feet, or a roof over his head. He's like the flies in the air. They don't have any of that either. He is somewhere between 7 and 13 years of age, lives in packs, wears his feet out walking, sleeps in the open, wears an old pair of pants of his father's that come down over his heels, an old hat from some other father that comes down over his ears, a single suspender with yellowing edges. He runs around on the lookout, on the take, killing time, primes pipes, swears like one of the damned, haunts cabarets, knows thieves, is on intimate terms with the streetwalkers, talks slang, sings dirty ditties, and hasn't got a nasty bone in his body. This is because he has a pearl in his soul, innocence, and pearls do not dissolve in mud. As long as man is a child, God would like him to be innocent. If you were to ask this vast city, "What on earth is that?" it would answer, "That's my boy." A few of his distinguishing marks. The little tramp, the gamin de Paris, is the giant city's dwarf. Let's not get carried away. This cherub of the gutter does sometimes have a shirt, but then only one. He does sometimes have shoes, but then they don't have soles. He does sometimes have a place to stay, and he loves it, for that is where he finds his mother, but he prefers the street, for that is where he finds his freedom. He has his own games, his own pranks, basically fueled by hatred of the bourgeois, his own metaphors. He calls being dead eating dandelions by the root. His own occupations, such as hailing cabs, fiacres, letting down carriage steps, collecting tolls for getting people from one side of the street to the other in heavy rains, which he calls doing the Pont des Arts, crying out the speeches made by the powers that be in favor of the French people, scraping up the gaps between cobblestones. He has his own currency, which consists of all the tiny bits of beaten copper you can find on the public thoroughfare. This curious currency, which goes by the name of loc, or tatters, enjoys an invariable and highly regulated exchange rate within this little bohemia of children. Last, he has his own fauna, which he studiously observes in corners. The ladybug, the death's head plant louse, the daddy longlegs, a black insect known as the devil, which has a tail armed with two horns that it twists when it wants to be menacing. He has his fabulous monster that has scales on its belly but is not a lizard, that has pustules on its back but is not a toad, that lives in the holes of old lime kilns and dried-out cesspools, black, hairy, slimy, slithering, now slow, now fast, that does not cry but just looks, and is so terrible no one has ever seen it. He calls this monster Deffy. Looking for Deffies among stones is a pleasure of the thrilling kind. Another pleasure is to suddenly lift up a cobblestone and see woodlice. Every part of Paris is famous for the interesting finds you can make there. There are earwigs in the Ursulines depots. There are millipedes at the Pantheon. There are tadpoles in the moats of the Champ de Mars. As for words, this child is on a par with Talleyrand. He is just as cynical, too, but more honest. He is endowed with an incredible and unpredictable cheerfulness. He stuns the shopkeeper with his fits of laughter. His range goes merrily from high comedy to farce. A funeral passes. Among those accompanying the dead, there is a doctor. "Hey," cries a gamin, "since when do doctors lug their work around?" Another one is in a crowd, A grave-looking man, adorned with spectacles and a bracelet with lucky charms, whips round indignantly. "You little swine, you just pinched my wife's waist." "Me, monsieur? Search me." He is nice. Of an evening, thanks to the few sous he always manages to scrape together for himself, this homuncio steps into a theater. In crossing the magic threshold, he is transfigured. He was a gutter snipe. He becomes a cocky Parisian theatergoer. Theaters are like upside-down ships, with the hold on top. It is up into this hold that this artful dodger piles. The cocky Parisian theatergoer is to the gamin what the moth is to the grub, the same creature taking wing and soaring. All he has to do is be there, with his radiant happiness, with his powerful enthusiasm and joy, with his hands clapping like beating wings for this cramped, fetid, dark, sordid, insalubrious, awful, abominable hold to turn into paradise, the gods. Give a being what is useless, and take away from him what is essential, and you have the gamin. The gamin is not without literary intuition. What he tends to go in for, and we say this with the proper dose of regret, is not in the classical taste. He is not, by nature, especially academic. Which is why, to give an example, the popularity of Mademoiselle Mar among this little audience of stormy children was seasoned with a hint of irony. The gamin called her Mademoiselle Mache, lamb's lettuce. This specimen heckles, jeers, sneers, likes a good brawl, wears a toddler's tatters and the rags of a philosopher, fishes in the sewer, hunts in the cesspool, digs gaiety out of muck, lashes the highways and byways with his verve, sniggers and bites, boos and sings, applauds and hurls abuse, tempers the hallelujah with Tiralira by the river, belts out every tune from De Profundis to carnival numbers, finds, without having to look, knows what he does not know, is Spartan to the point of fraud, is mad to the point of wisdom, is lyrical to the point of being foul, would squat even on Olympus, wallows in dung, and comes out of it covered in stars. The gamin de Paris is Rabelais as a boy. He isn't happy with his pants unless they have a fob pocket. Nothing much phases him, still less frightens him. He derides superstition, deflates exaggeration, makes a mockery of mysteries, pokes his tongue out at ghosts, knocks people off their high horses, caricatures epic aggrandizement. Not that he's prosaic, far from it, but he swaps the solemn vision for comical fantasies. If Adamastor the giant were to pop in front of him, the gamin would say, "Well, well, a little nipper." He can be useful. Paris begins with the dawdling onlooker and ends with the gamin, two beings that no other town is capable of. The passive acceptance that makes a person happy just to look on, and inexhaustible initiative, prudhomme and fouillou. Paris alone boasts such native fauna. The monarchy begins and ends in the ambulatory onlooker. Anarchy begins and ends in the gamin. This wan child of the working-class faubourg of Paris lives and grows, ties himself in knots and pulls through in suffering, a thoughtful witness to social realities and human affairs, and he doesn't miss a trick. He believes that he himself is unconcerned, but he is not. He watches, ready to have a laugh, ready for other things too. Whoever you are, you who go by the name of prejudice, abuse, ignominy, oppression, iniquity, despotism, injustice, fanaticism, tyranny, watch out for the wide-eyed gamin. This little kid will grow up. What clay is he made of? Of the first lump of muck that turns up in the gutter. A handful of mud, a breath of air, and voila, Adam. All that is needed is for a god to pass. A god has always passed over the gamin. Fortune plays a hand in this small creature. By that word fortune we mean there is an element of luck. Will this pygmy, needed in nothing but common dirt, pig-ignorant, illiterate, dim-witted, vulgar, crude, grow into an Ionian or a Boeotian. Wait, curit rota, the wheel turns. The spirit of Paris, that demon that creates children of chance and men of destiny, unlike the Latin potter, turns the common or garden-variety jug into an amphora. His boundaries. The gamin loves the city. He also loves solitude, having something of the sage in him. Urbis amator, like Fuscus. Rurus amator, like Flaccus. Wandering around, musing, in other words, dawdling, is a good way to spend time for a philosopher, particularly in that funny, rather ugly, semi-rural landscape with its odd dual nature that surrounds certain big cities, notably Paris. To observe the urban outskirts is to observe the amphibian. End of trees, beginning of roofs. End of grass, beginning of pavement. End of furrows, beginning of shops. End of ruts, beginning of passions. End of divine murmuring, beginning of human racket. Whence the extraordinary interest. And whence the seemingly aimless promenades of the thinker in these rather uninviting places forever branded by passers-by with the epithet sad. The person writing these lines was for a long time a prowler of the barrière of Paris, and for him that prowling is a source of indelible memories. The bald turf, the rocky paths, the chalk, the limey clay, the rubble, the harsh monotony of fallow land and uncultivated land, the early fruit and vegetable crops of the market gardeners suddenly appearing under cover somewhere, that blend of the wild and the primly bourgeois, the vast deserted recesses where the garrison drums hold noisy lessons, reproducing the stammering staccato of battle, these places that are solitary retreats during the day, death traps at night, the spindly mill turning in the wind, the excavation wheels of the stone quarries, the open-air bars on cemetery corners, the mysterious charm of the great dark walls that cut through vast wastelands flooded with sunlight and full of butterflies. All this drew him. There is hardly anyone on earth who knows these singular places. Glacière, Cunette, the hideous Grenelle wall riddled with bullet holes, Montparnasse, the Fosse aux Loups, the Aubier on the banks of the Marne, Montsouris, the Tombissoir, the Pierre Plate du Châtillon, where there is an old, exhausted quarry that only serves now to push up mushrooms and is shut off at ground level by a trapdoor of rotten boards. The Campagna around Rome is one thing, the suburbs of Paris another. To see nothing in what a horizon offers us but fields, houses, or trees is to stick to the surface, for all aspects of things are God's thoughts. The place where a plain meets a town is always impregnated with some indefinable but penetrating melancholy. Nature and humanity speak to you there at the same time. Local peculiarities flourish. Anyone who has wandered around as we have through these lonely spots on the fringe of our faubourg, and that we might lump together as the limbo of Paris, would have glimpsed here and there, dotted about in the most abandoned spots, at the most unexpected moments, behind a scrawny hedge or in the angle of some grimy wall, boisterous groups of children, way-faced, covered in mud, covered in dust, scruffy, disheveled, playing jacks, crowned with cornflowers. Little as they are all runaways from poor families. Outside on the boulevard is where they can breathe. The suburban fringe belongs to them. That is where they skip school all day permanently. It is where they innocently belt out their repertoire of dirty songs. It is where they are, or better still, where they exist, far from all eyes, in the delicious May or June sun, kneeling around a hole in the ground, flicking marbles with their thumbs, squabbling over worthless coins, carefree, carried away, unbridled, happy. But as soon as they spot you, they remember they have a trade, and that they have to make a living, and they offer to sell you an old woolen stocking full of cockchafers or a clump of lilac. These encounters with strange children are one of the charms of the outskirts of Paris, lovely and poignant at the same time. Sometimes in the heaps of boys, there are a few little girls, their sisters, who are almost big girls, skinny, feverish, covered in sunburn, dusted with freckles, with spikes of rye and poppies in their hair, gay, wild-eyed, barefoot. You see them eating cherries in the wheat fields. At night, you hear them laughing. These groups, warmly lit in the full blaze of noon or half-glimpsed at twilight, keep the dreamer busy for a long while, and such visions find their way into his dreams. Paris, center, outskirts, circumference. To these children, this is the whole world. They never risk going beyond it. They can no more live out of the atmosphere of Paris than fish can live out of water. For them, there is nothing 2 leagues past its gates. Iry, Gentilly, Arcueil, Belleville, Aubervilliers, Ménilmontant, Choisy-le-Roi, Billancourt, Meudon, Issy, Vanves, Sèvres, Puteaux, Neuilly, Gennevilliers, Colombes, Romainville, Château, Agnières, Bougival, Nanterre, Enghien, Noisy-le-Sec, Nogent, Gournay, Drancy, Gonesse. This is where the world ends. A bit of history. At the time when the action of this book occurred, which is, after all, virtually contemporary, there was not, as there is today, a police officer on every street corner, an advantage there is no time to discuss here. Paris was crawling with stray children. Statistics show an average of 260 homeless children were picked up annually by police on the beat in open terrain, in houses under construction and under the arches of bridges. One such nest that has remained famous produced the Swallows of the Pont d'Arcole. This is, of course, the most disastrous social symptom. All the crimes of the man begin in the straying of the child. We should accept Paris, though. Relatively speaking, and notwithstanding the memories just called to mind, the exception is only fair. Whereas in any other big city, a child vagabond means a lost man, whereas almost everywhere the child left to his own devices is practically dedicated and abandoned to a kind of fatal immersion in out-and-out vices that eat away at his honesty and even at his conscience. The gamin de Paris, we must insist, no matter how rough and damaged on the surface, is more or less intact on the inside. Something that is wonderful to note, and that bursts out in the splendid probity of our popular revolutions, is that a certain incorruptibility results from ideas that are in the air of Paris the way salt is in the ocean. To breathe Paris preserves the soul. What we are saying here in no way detracts from the pang you feel every time you run into one of these children who seem to have the cut ties of the broken home floating all around them. In today's civilization, still so incomplete, it is not so unusual to see such breakdowns, with families falling apart in the shadows, parents having little idea of what has become of their children and spilling their guts on the public highway. Hence, dark destinies. This is known, for this sad business has led to the coining of a phrase, to be thrown out on the streets of Paris. We should just say in passing that such abandonment of children was not discouraged by the erstwhile monarchy. A touch of Egypt and Bohemia in the lower orders accommodated the upper spheres and suited the purposes of the high and mighty. Hate-filled opposition to the education of lower-class children was a dogma. What was the good of a little learning? That was the catch cry. Well, the stray child is the corollary of the ignorant child. Besides, the monarchy sometimes needed children, and when it did, it skimmed the street. Louis XIV, to go no further back in time, wanted to build a naval fleet. For very good reason, nothing wrong with the idea, but let's just look at the way they went about it. No fleet can exist unless, alongside the sailing ship, which is a plaything of the wind, you have a ship that can go wherever it likes, either by means of oars or by means of steam, in order to tow this sailing ship if need be. In those days, galleys were to the Navy what steamers are today. So there had to be galleys, but a galley can only be moved by galley slaves. So there had to be galley slaves. Colbert made sure as many galley slaves as possible were churned out by provincial intendants and the parliaments. The judges were more than happy to oblige. If a man kept his hat on his head before a procession, as the Huguenots did, he was sent to the galleys. If a boy was caught on the street, as long as he was at least 15 years old and had nowhere to lay his head, he was sent to the galleys. Great reign, great age. Under Louis XV, children disappeared in Paris, kidnapped by the police for no one knows what mysterious purpose. People whispered in horror of monstrous possibilities involving the king's blood-red baths. Barbier speaks naively of these matters. It sometimes happened that the press gangs, known as the exempt gangs, when they were short on children, took some that had fathers. The fathers ran after the exempt gangs in desperation. In such cases, the parliament intervened and hanged. Who? The exempt gangs? No. The fathers. The gamin would have his place in the caste system of India. The gaminerie of Paris, the Parisian order of gamins, is almost a caste. You could say not everyone can get in. The word gamin was printed for the first time, thereby passing from the vernacular into the language of literature, in 1834. It is in a little work entitled Claude Gueux that the word makes its appearance. It created a real scandal, but the word was adopted. The things that attract esteem for a gamin among his cohorts are very varied. We knew and had dealings with one who was very much respected and very much admired for having seen a man fall from the top of one of the towers of Notre Dame, another for having managed to get into a rear courtyard where the statues from the Dome of the Invalides had been temporarily deposited and having swiped a bit of the lead off one, a third for having seen a coach tip over, yet another because he knew a soldier who had almost knocked out some bourgeois gent's eye. This explains that exclamation of the Parisian gamin, a profound epiphenomenon that the vulgar laugh at without understanding. Hell's bells, talk about unlucky, to think I still ain't seen anyone falling out of a fifth floor. Haven't, pronounced ain't, and fifth, pronounced fifth. There is such a thing as fine peasant talk, and the following is an example. Father so-and-so, your wife has died of her illness. Why didn't you send for a doctor? Why do you think, monsieur, we poor people have to die for ourselves? But if all the taunting passivity of the peasant is packed into that expression, all the free-thinking anarchy of the cheeky suburban nipper is packed, indubitably, into this other. A man in the cart taking him to the gallows is listening to his confessor. The child of Paris shouts a protest. He's talking to his sacristy rat. God, what a scaredy-cat! A certain boldness in religious matters enlivens the gamin. Being strong-minded is important. Attending executions constitutes a duty. You point out the guillotine to each other and laugh. You have all kinds of pet names for it. Bottom of the soup, cranky pants, the mother in the blue yonder in the sky, the last mouthful, etc., etc. So as not to miss anything, you scale walls, hoist yourself up onto balconies, climb trees, hang off railings, cling to chimneys. The gamin is a born roofer just as he is a born sailor. A roof doesn't frighten him any more than a mast. No festival comes near La Grève. Sanson and the Abbé Montès are the true stars. You boo the victim to encourage him. Sometimes you admire him. Lacenaire, as a gamin, saw the awful Dautin die bravely and came out with this expression that was to have quite a future. I was jealous of him. In the order of gamins, you don't know Voltaire, but you know Papavoine. You put politicals in the same basket as murderers. You have traditions based on the last clothes worn by all of them. You know that Talleyrand wore a driver's cap, Avril a cap of otter skin, Louvel a round hat, that old Delaporte was bald and bareheaded, that Costin was all pink and pretty as a rose, that Boris had a romantic goatee that Jean Martin kept his braces on, that Le Couffet and his mother were arguing. "Don't fight over spilt milk," one gamin yelled at them. Another gamin, wanting to see de Baquer go past and being too little to see anything in the crowd, spotted a lamppost on the quay and started climbing it. A gendarme stationed there scowled at him. "Let me climb up, Monsieur Gendarme," said the gamin. And to soften up the authority figure, he added, "I won't fall." "I couldn't care less if you fall or not," answered the gendarme. In the gaminerie, a memorable accident is highly prized. You attain the height of esteem if you manage to cut yourself badly to the bone. The fist is not a bad way to achieve respect either. One thing the gamin most likes saying is, "I'm as strong as all get-out, I am." To be left-handed makes you most enviable. To squint is highly rated. In which you will read a delightful saying of the king's. In summer he turns into a frog, and in the evening at nightfall, down by the bridges of Austerlitz and Iena, from the top of coal barges and the boats of washerwomen, he plunges headfirst into the Seine, and into all possible infringements of the laws of modesty and of the police. But police officers are on the lookout, and there ensues a highly dramatic situation, of the kind that once gave rise to a memorable fraternal cry. This cry, which was famous around 1830, was a strategic warning telegraphed from gamin to gamin. It scans like lines of Homer, with a notation almost as inexpressible as the Eleusinian lamentations of the Panathenaea. And it brings the antique Aeoi to mind. Here's how it goes. "Yoo-hoo, joker! Yoo-hoo! There's flatfoots about! There's cops! Grab your gear and beat it! Cut through the sewer!" Sometimes this kid, for that is what this midget likes to go by, can read. Sometimes he can write. He can always scrawl. He doesn't hesitate to endow himself, by we know not what mysterious mutual instruction, with all those talents that can be so useful in public life. From 1815 to 1830, he imitated the call of the turkey. From 1830 to 1848, he scrawled pears on walls. One summer evening, Louis-Philippe was coming home on foot and saw a gamin, a tiny little thing knee-high to a grasshopper, sweating away, stretching high up on tiptoe, to charcoal in a gigantic pear on one of the pillars of the Neuilly Gate. The king, with that easy good nature that he got from Henri IV, helped the little lad finish the pear for him and gave the boy a gold louis, telling him, "The pear's on that, too." The gamin loves uproar. A certain violent state pleases him. He loathes curés. One day, in the Rue de l'Université, one of these little rascals was making faces at the porte cochère of number 69. "What are you doing that to the door for?" a passerby asked. The boy replied, "There's a curé in there." The papal nuncio does, in fact, reside at that address. Yet, whatever the gamin's Voltairean tendencies, if the occasion presents itself to become a choir boy, he may very well take it up, and if he does, he serves perfectly politely at Mass. He is like Tantalus when it comes to two overriding ambitions that constantly elude him, to overthrow the government and to patch up his pants. The gamin, at his best, is on top of all the police constables of Paris and can always put a name to a face when he meets one. He ticks them off on his fingers. He studies their ways and keeps special tabs on every one of them. He can read the soul of a policeman like an open book, and will tell you frankly and without batting an eyelid, "So-and-so is a traitor. So-and-so is a nasty piece of work. So-and-so is terrific. So-and-so is a joke." All these terms, traitor, nasty piece of work, terrific, a joke, have a specific accepted meaning in his mouth. "This one thinks he owns the Pont Neuf and stops society strolling along the cornice outside the parapets. That one is always pulling a person's ears." And so on, and so forth. The old soul of Gaul. There was something of this little urchin in Poquelin, son of Les Halles. There was something of him in Beaumarchais. Gaminerie is a tonal variation on the Gallic spirit, mixed with common sense. It occasionally reinforces it, as alcohol fortifies wine. Sometimes it is a defect. Homer goes on, we know. And you could say Voltaire plays the gamin, he gamines. Camille Desmoulins was from the suburbs. Championnet, who abused miracles, was a child of the streets of Paris. When still very little, he flooded the porticos of Saint-Jean-de-Beauvais and Saint-Étienne-du-Mont, and he was on such intimate terms with Saint-Genevieve's shrine as to order about St. Januarius's glass vial, causing the blood to suddenly liquefy at will. The gamin de Paris is respectful, ironic, and insolent. He has horrible teeth because he is malnourished, and his stomach suffers, but he has beautiful eyes because he has wit. Faced with Jehovah himself, he would hop up the steps of paradise. He is strong in French boxing. There is nothing he could not grow into. He plays in the gutter and rises up out of it in revolt. His effrontery persists in the face of grapeshot. He was once a little gutter snipe. He is now a hero. Just like the Theban boy, he shakes the lion's skin. The drummer Barat was a gamin de Paris. He yells forward march the way the war horse in the scriptures says ha, and in a second goes from a waif to a giant. This child of the quagmire is also a child of the ideal. Just try and measure the range that can go from Molière to Barat. At the end of the day, and to cut a long story short, the gamin is a specimen that amuses himself because he is unhappy. Ecce Paris, ecce homo. To sum up once more, the gamin de Paris today, like the Griculus of Rome in days gone by, is the man of the people as a child, with the wrinkles of the old world on his forehead. The gamin is a national treasure and, at the same time, a disease. A disease that must be cured. How? By light. Light purifies. Light enlightens. All the generous radiance society spreads stems from science, letters, the arts, learning. Make men, make real men. Enlighten them if you want them to warm you. Sooner or later, the magnificent matter of universal education will come up with the irresistible authority of absolute truth. And when it does, those that rule under the watchful eye of the French ideal of enlightenment will have to make the following choice: the children of France, or the street urchins of Paris. Flames in the light of day, or will-o'-the-wisps in the dark. The gamin embodies Paris, and Paris embodies the world. For Paris is what it all adds up to. Paris is the ceiling over the human race. This whole prodigious city is a condensation of dead customs and creeds and living customs and creeds. Whoever sees Paris feels like they have seen the hidden side of the whole of history, with the sky and the constellations and the gaps in between. Paris has its capital, the Hôtel de Ville, a Parthenon, Notre Dame, an Aventine hill, the Faubourg Saint-Antoine, an Asinarium, the Sorbonne, a Pantheon, the Panthéon, a Via Sacra, the Boulevard des Italiens, a Tower of the Winds, public opinion, which has replaced the Gemonie with public ridicule. Its major domo is the vulgar dandy. Its Transteverino is the working-class suburbanite. Its native bearer is the Leal market porter. Its Lazzarone is the underworld. Its Cockney is the fop. Everything found elsewhere is found in Paris. The fishwife of Dumarsais could hold her own with Euripides' herb hawker. The discus thrower, Vigenus, is resurrected in Forioso the tightrope walker. Theropontigonus Miles would go arm in arm with the Grenadier Vadeboncoeur. Damasippus the junk dealer would be happy among the curiosity shops. Vincennes would get stuck into Socrates, just as the Agora would put Diderot behind bars. Grimaud de la Reynière came up with roast beef, with Yorkshire pudding, just the way Curtullus invented roast hedgehog. We see popping up once more under the